And we are back for another Day of the Dots, joined as always by the Brain Trust, Mr. Chase Taylor. And kind of 2 days mixed into one. Kind of had the first half of the day, and all of a sudden the last hour, everything, it doesn't matter what it is, sold off in synchronized fashion. Where are we finishing on the day, Chase? We're 1 minute. Here, there's the close. Where do we finish on the indexes?
Down about 0.25% on everything. So pretty simple.
And you mean everything.
Yeah, because that's S&P, Qs, IWM, all, 20 to 35 basis points down. So
is there anything to glean from that? I think it's funny. When I look at a day like today, my first thought is just all the factor nonsense. Like, when you see everything, like all these different sectors, just moving in the same direction at one time based on no news. I look at that. And again, I think the biggest mistake in the world is to look at anything over the short term. So when we're talking about one trading day, I don't want to make a mountain out of a molehill here, but it's just interesting to watch that, you and I have been talking about this for a long time, right? These factor dynamics. And when we talk about factor dynamics, what we're talking about, guys, is like so many of these automated and trend chasing, algorithmic type quant programs that are based off these interrelationships, right? So when this goes up, we buy this or we sell that, and most of it is there's guys that do it manually, but most of it in today's market, I think on a volume basis. So if you're looking at, the volume of dollars, I think most of those factor type investment models are going to be working off algorithms and equations and things of that nature. So when you look at moves like today, like I said, I just think it was interesting because there wasn't really, what it looked like to me, honestly, it looked like to me, if you just showed me the tape, as well as like the commodity complex, and you just showed me everything, including rates, I would have thought dollar shot up.
Yeah. And it was up, but nothing.
Yeah. But pretty constant throughout the day. Yeah. Right. Like it didn't spike.
It did close on the highs, but it was up 10 basis points. So it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just that's like a lane change.
I think semiconductors like having a bit of a ugly last hour probably was a good bit of it. And Mag7 itself finished the day down 0.7. So kind of led to the downside by that stuff. SMCI actually went from green to red. NVIDIA closed down about 2.5%. So Microsoft down on the day. Getting some mega cap tech weakness definitely doesn't help those indexes.
No. What's interesting, though, is that the momentum portfolio finished up on the day. We finished right in line. Value finished right in line with the S&P down 0.2, 0.25, something like that. Momentum finished up almost 0.5%.
Interesting indeed. That was one of the first things I thought to myself. Was like, wonder how like not necessarily our momentum portfolio, but momentum as a factor did, because that it's so stretched. Like,
yeah,
that was one of the first thoughts I had. Like, maybe that's just finally.
Well, this is why I think it's a good idea to have two different models in your client's portfolio. There you go. Right? A day like today, where value flipped negative toward the end, and we were coasting green pretty much all day, weren't we?
Yeah, we were like up
30
up to 10 bips most of the day.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden like nuked, and I was like, whoa, it's not a good feeling. And you go look at the market, and it's like, oh, the market went down right with you. So I was like, okay, well, this is just like a lot of beta.
Yeah. We did see some interesting data out today, though. Well, okay, so hold on. Bitcoin still sitting right around 70,000. Rates, I see the 10-year was down to about 4.23. I don't know. I kind of look at the 10-year yield between 4.2 and 4.3, sort of like no man's land.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Break above 4.3, hold there. I think you probably need to, buckle up.
Yeah, I would say 4.35 above that.
Okay,
really on, and then on the downside, probably 4.1 below that, and it starts to look weird.
Yeah. So kind of par for the course. Where did oil finish red on the day too?
Yes. Down to like 0.5%, I think it was. Let me look. Yeah, oil down about 0.5%. 81.50 is the close. Gasoline though down over 1.5%. So pretty decent down day for gasoline.
You know what's incredible to me, and I mean, it's not like nobody's paying attention. I mean, there's plenty of people paying attention. You hear it all over the internet. This move in crypto is pretty amazing to me, considering the backdrop. I mean, again, I just have to get used to the fact that I have to get used to, you know, in my mind, bifurcating liquidity and rates. But it still is.
Yeah, it's a very important distinction to
me. Yeah. But it is still fascinating watching crypto break out, and several of them break out to new all-time highs, despite the fact that interest rates are 550 basis points higher than they were the last time this happened.
And but you said it though. I mean, it's
liquidity.
And yeah, I think, and you're not the only one that's been struggled with that. Like, I've been slow to make the shift to understanding which of those two forces is more important these days. But it's very clear that liquidity is the one that actually moves things, not short-term rates. It doesn't mean they're completely unimportant, but
I the way I'm looking at it is I think that they're linked, right? But I think that and you and I have talked about this at great length, but the more and more I watch this market and more I watch these scenarios play out, the more and more I'm convinced that moving rates was all about increasing and decreasing liquidity. You know, that if you could be, because if you leave well enough alone, if there isn't a, you know, if you don't, you know, if you don't start throwing off 6.5-7% deficits GDP, if you don't have the Fed splashing $350 billion on a term funding plan for banks and all that kind of stuff, if you raise rates, that is going to suck liquidity out of the market.
Yeah, all else is equal. It's just not equal.
No, it's just not equal. Right. Because that's not what's happening.
Right.
Right. Which is really fascinating to me because I don't think I could be 100% wrong on this. I don't think the Fed recognizes that. And if they do, they're not say they, you know, they publicly, they would say that they don't think that that's the case. Maybe behind closed doors, they do.
Yeah. I mean, I would hope they understand what's going on the liquidity side. And I think they do because.
Yeah, but we didn't. I don't know that. Yeah. And I don't know that they did because. I feel like you and I are pretty well read on these kind of things. And I remember having that discussion back when they did the Silicon Valley Bank bailout. And it, you know, it wasn't just you and me, but I mean, there's a lot of people sitting there going, okay, how does this work now that when you're injecting massive amounts of liquidity and raising rates at the same time, which one wins that tug of war? Well, it doesn't surprise me that liquidity does, right? Because like I said, if I'm right in the way that I'm looking at rates, is that I think the biggest impact on rates is that they are the dog, or excuse me, well, what would it be? Yeah, I mean, effectively, well, that's not a bad, it's not a tail wagging the dog type scenario. But interest rates are sort of the stopgap between liquidity and monetary decision, or do you know what I'm trying to get at here? Like the whole point of rates going up and down is the impact it has on liquidity, right? And I never really viewed it that way. I thought that rates go up, cost of lending goes up. It doesn't matter how much liquidity you have, it's going to slow things down, right? But then as I think about it and I think about the way economics works, right? For instance, if the only way you can get out of a sticky situation, let's say you're a builder or a contractor or something like that, is you got to roll a loan, right? Even if you have to do it at a higher rate, you can the water keeps moving through the shark's gills, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, so that was the point I was going to make is if GDP is high, let's call it nominal. If nominal GDP is high, if wage gains are high, if unemployment's low, all those things are met, like it's not that hard to overcome pretty high short-term rates, at least for a period of time, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a mistake myself and a lot of people made in the last year was like viewing that short term rate spike as like, oh, this is inevitably, you know, pretty soon here going to start hurting stuff. Well, if growth was flat and wages were flat, it absolutely would have blown a bunch of stuff up, but that wasn't the case. You know, growth was high, inflation was high. So it creates tons of wiggle room for people to not have to deal with that. Plus just the can kicking and creative financing and the ability to extend and pretend for debtors and for creditors, like that is the kind of thing where you can buy a good bit of time to not have to deal with those problems, especially after everyone just went out of the way to buy themselves time anyways, because you went from zero rates where everyone refied, you know, to 5.5. And like we talk about all the time, no, not many people had to pay that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in that situation that we just came through, so I would argue moving forward in all situations, liquidity is gonna be more important than short rates, but, you had the perfect storm for liquidity to matter more than interest rates in the last 2 years.
Well, why do you say that?
Just because you had such a massive refi boom where everyone got away from the short-term rate where it wasn't going to impact you. If you refied your house and you're a corporation and you pushed out all your debt, you know, 5 years in the future, like you can raise the you know, 3 month lending rate all you want on me. Like, it doesn't matter because I'm not paying it. I locked in my debt for 5, 10, 30 years. So like, I don't care what the 6 month yield is.
Yeah. Having said that, I do think if the Fed was, if, you know, and not just the Fed, the Treasury and the government too, but I think if they government, if those parties would have been more traditional and more disciplined as it relates to their injections of liquidity, I do think the rates would have had a bigger impact.
Yeah. And I think we were on our way to that in October of 22.
Yeah.
When everything bottomed. And if you go back, the reason everything bottomed, so we were actually removing liquidity. So like it was rates up and liquidity down. And then we had the gilts crisis in the UK. And I think that scared the crap out of the authorities in the US. And they're like, we're not letting that happen. So that was when they flipped the switch and we basically started doing stealth QE, stopped. You could refer to it as a like sanitizing interest rate hikes, sanitizing QT, because like we've talked about 2023, like sure, like rates were high, but you had net liquidity injection into the economy. So like, who cares what the short rate is if you're adding liquidity? And I think that all goes back to that, to the UK, like all of a sudden having their bond market just kind of, you know, flip them off. And ever since then, we've been adding liquidity and more or less, you know.
It really is at least to me, in the way I'm viewing it, I think it really is it's a very interesting financial and economic experiment. Meaning, you know, I don't think it's ever been done, and I would gladly admit if I am wrong, and if anybody knows that, feel free to DM me or something like that. But I don't think you've ever had central banks, certainly here in the United States, you know, through I don't believe that central banks have ever viewed the liquidity scenario like these guys currently do. You know, like you and I have talked about so many times. It's very clear to me. I think through words and through actions, it's very clear to me that the Fed at some point decided that their job was to have ample liquidity in markets at all time. And that's a very unnatural thing. You know, we've never really seen that before.
Yeah, I think you're just at a stage where Congress isn't trying to take any medicine, the Treasury's not trying to take any medicine, and the Fed's not trying to take any medicine.
Right.
So like no one is willing to kind of step in there and go, you know what, this is Like the Powell speech of Jackson Hole a couple years ago, like where he warned, hey, there's pain coming. Like maybe he was willing to eat some pain then. We didn't get it, but it just feels like no one's willing to actually force pain into any of this. So as an investing, you know, from an investment backdrop, that means you're going to get pretty significant devaluation of your currency versus real stuff, and you're going to get inflation and asset prices are going to go up.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't see any way around that. But like we were talking in our investment meeting this morning, you know, nothing's changed obviously in the fundamental view that we've got, but holy smokes, is it hard for me to keep long here? I mean, the bullish sentiment is just ridiculous. You sent me a chart via DM today. Why don't you explain that chart a little bit to what the folks – so, yeah.
So the conference board and University of Michigan does this too, where they kind of ask people about how they think the stock market's going to do. Now, just to be clear, like it is largely as always, like all these things are like kind of a 6 month moving average of where you've been, and then these people just extrapolate it. But if you were to close the quarter, well, we are about to close the quarter this week, so it will be the highest closing quarter on this reading for the conference board for where people think the stock market is going to go in the future. So like from that standpoint, these consumers have never been more bullish a stock market
ever.
And University of Michigan is pretty similar, where like, hey, how do you feel about, you know, your retirement account is more or less what they're asking in that one. And it's rocket shipped. And these were very depressed not that long ago. And if you look at like AAII's bull and bear indicator and the spread between those two, those have spent some pretty significant times. So like back in 2022, we had the most bears ever on that thing. And now you're, I'd probably bottom quartile of history, perked up a little bit at least, but still like there's just not very many bears out there. So the mood around where the stock market is going to go in the future is just totally extrapolating what we've done in the last 6 months, as human beings love to do.
Yep. You got to love that. Trying to think anything else we have to cover. What other data? We had a bunch of data come out to you. Cover some of it, but go over what we saw.
So we got, more soft data that was bad. So Philly Fed's regional, services data was pretty bad. We had Dallas come out with their services index, which again was pretty bad. And you read through the comments, and it's kind of hilarious because people are complaining more or less about one or two things, and pinning blame on their struggles on one or two things: either too much inflation or rates are too high. So it's just kind of hilarious to see people. So people are saying like, "I want inflation and rates down."
It's, yeah.
Like, well. Good luck with that.
Well, we have a cake. Kind of funny how that, we're in a cake and eat it too world, man.
Yeah. So now, yeah, Warren Mosler might argue like, hey, you lower rates, you might get lower inflation. And that might even be true. But I just found that kind of interesting. We also had like durable goods and stuff. I just don't really pay too much attention to it because it's so noisy. We had home prices come through negative on FHFA for the first time in quite a few months. So is at least from a pricing standpoint, real estate's really calmed down lately. Make sure I'm not forgetting one. We also had the conference board, like actual consumer confidence stuff, the present situation was pretty high. Expectations dropped a lot, which is funny because it's the opposite for these manufacturing indexes and these regional surveys for, well, manufacturing or services. The current readings are terrible. And then if you ask any of them what they think 6 months out, that stuff's starting to hockey stick and fly, which just in general, I find interesting. But yeah, that was it. We also had Richmond Fed, which again came in worse than expected. That one's manufacturing. And one thing you and I talked about this morning on the investment meeting was conference board. They have a jobs plentiful and a jobs hard to get. And if you chart the spread of that, it kind of helps you get a feel for the labor market. And that had started to like really come down, which suggested you had a good chance of getting the unemployment rate to pop. But now that it has started to like kind of trend higher lately, and it's at the highest level since I want to say like summer last year, something like that. So now it's kind of pointing to, no, you're not going to jump above 4% unemployment, at least not in the next month or two. It doesn't look like, judging by that. It's not like a perfect indicator, but it's historically decent. So that tells me the labor market might hold up decently in here. Obviously along with inflation perking up on pretty much every way I can find.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it's like we were talking about, man. If you look at the sentiment indicators, it's very unnerving. And, you know, people are like, oh, and you're like, no, sentiment has been a very good, you know, it's pretty basic, right? Like you get everybody to one side of the boat and, you know, there's only so much it can go. You know, it's only so far it can list till other people start moving back to the other side of the boat. That being said, it just feels like we've been hanging out on the same side of the boat for a really long time.
Yeah, that's true. Like whether it's sentiment or positioning or systematic positioning that you know, we track and talk about so closely here. It's all been stretched for like good 2-3 months now, where like thankfully we've been smart enough to not just see that and get out of the way. But at the same time, like every day it makes you a little more nervous as that kind of piles up, because history suggests when all those things get fairly stretched, like you intend to have a problem. And today was notable because dealer positioning was really flat, which means by the close, they probably went into negative gamma, which means if you get a sell off into tomorrow, they would have to go out and sell underlying equity to kind of, you know, keep their books square. So if you get into that situation, that's where now we've gotten in that situation probably 3 times in the last 6 months and nothing bad happened. But it opens up the possibility of getting a feedback loop that feeds itself to the downside, and where you get selling that begets other selling. So just notable going into the next couple of days on that standpoint. But not only have we had those, you know, the sentiment and positioning and the systematic positioning all in the same spot, but you've had a lot of concentration and like everyone buying the same mega cap tech stuff. So like the way I've been kind of thinking of it is that not only are all our investors all on the same side of the boat, they're on like the same like section of the same side of the boat.
Yeah.
Which just further makes it
they're in the same chair.
Sketchy, right.
There's 10 dudes stacked on top of each other sitting in the same chair.
Yeah, like the train memes like from India where there's like a 1,000 people on like 2 train cars.
Yeah. Or like 20 people packed in the back of like SR10.
And that's what makes like a move like today in NVIDIA, which is not a huge move, down 2.5%, but like, you know, not a great looking daily candle. And we've had a few of these in the last couple months again, but just it puts you, you know, a little, you have to sit in the edge of your seat a little bit closer whenever you see the supreme leader start to show softness.
I've never seen sentiment though get this like it's even funny now, because that remember I was telling you about that Adam Silver guy or whatever, I can't remember what his last name was. I think it's Adam Silver, Adam Parker, anyway, from Morgan Stanley. And he was referring to, if you're not long NVIDIA, like, what do you think you are, a god? Like, everybody else is wrong and you're not, and you just have to be long that thing. And so now NVIDIA is being referred to as the god trade.
If anything is going to put a top on something, that you.
I know, but this is the thing about this cycle. Like, we've seen all of this, and one of the things that we have learned, like, just it's a lesson I'll never forget, is that liquidity trumps all.
Oh, 100%. And liquidity loves to find the narrative, the meme, like.
Oh, loves it.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, you could just run a strategy where whatever the narrative of the day is, you just get in that bad boy whenever liquidity's, you know, flush, because you're going to do just—
Is it even fair to really call it liquidity at this point? Because to me, it's sort of like an economic hot wiring when you're running deficits this large. Right? When you talk about liquidity, it makes it just sound like you're talking about market conditions. But I think this is even more powerful, right? Because it's not just like it's not like the Fed is just pumping bank reserves into a term funding facility or something like that, right? Like not only is there ample liquidity in that way of looking at it, but then you're also providing direct liquidity injections via the deficit. Like, we don't think about it as liquidity in that way, but you know what I'm saying?
You want to talk about direct liquidity injections. I was just reading today about just one company, Intel. Obviously, we had the CHIPS Act, and then the IRA, but just Intel is getting, I was doing the math, and it was like $60 billion in just direct money from the government.
Jeez.
as subsidies, as subsidized loans, as grants, like a bunch of different ways of just handing them money to go build plants, you know, to build water intensive semiconductor plants in the desert of Arizona, things like that. Talk about direct. That's very direct. I mean, but to the point Michael Howell always makes on liquidity, like that's important to think about too, is it's not just central bank liquidity. That's like, I want to say like a fifth of liquidity. You throw in all the private sector liquidity and the role that collateral plays, and when financial conditions loosen, it becomes like a feedback loop where everyone has more money to, which is more collateral for more loans, which is more money. Like it just, you know, that's why it becomes like a cycle that really does, you know, have multi-year runs in them to the upside and downside. And we're fairly early innings on the upside run on this liquidity cycle. So,
yeah. And it, and you know, all these things would explain the elevated valuations too.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Like it makes sense. Like all of this stuff makes sense. Like for instance, if you show me a market and we know, I think this is a good example for people to understand what we mean by liquidity and how it can impact prices, right? If you show me a market that has, well, look, we don't even have to go down that path. We can just look at it this way. Go look at the difference between multiples for private companies and publicly traded companies right now, right? The only difference between them is liquidity. Right. That's the only difference. When you go public, you provide instantly, you know, via being able to sell your stock, you got instant liquidity. Okay. Does that deserve a premium on pricing? Liquidity? Sure. Does it deserve a 50 to 100% premium or in some cases even more than that? Of course not. That's ludicrous.
Right.
Right. But that's where you're at. And I think that I think that's, and again, I could be wrong, but I think that spread, and you'd have to look at it historically, I got to imagine we're pretty close to those highs, if not at them though. But the spread between the average multiple being paid in private markets versus what's being paid in public markets, it's got to be at or near an all-time high. And if I'm wrong, I'll eat it.
Maybe, but that's, if you are, that's just because private equity became the coolest thing you could do, you know, in the last 15 years. David Swensen was smart enough to go put a bunch of money in it, made a killing. So everyone decided to put all their money in it, all the big institutional players. So I think maybe that's wrong, but only because the institutional capital stampede into private, was so powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you know, you can kind of see it with Reddit, right? And like, I always tell people, like, you know, when you're seeing IPOs pop by 50% in a single day, it gives you an indicator. And the reason why it's important to note is that that is not the aim of the guys pricing those deals. Right? That is not the aim. That's not going to make their people – I mean, they're not going to be angry that their stock's up. But remember, that IPO price – and I think Reddit IPO'd at like 35, somewhere right around there. But that IPO price – that's the price that insiders at the company agreed to sell their stock at. Right? So watching it go up 50% on that day, if you bought it, that's good. But it's a very classic bubbly type sign. Meaning what the market is saying is, hey, we disagree with all the guys that priced this on Wall Street, and we disagree with the guys who own the company that agreed to sell their stock at this price.
Right.
And we think that the people that run the company are 50 to 60% off on pricing this.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the best ways to measure excess liquidity.
Yeah, IPOs.
And the jump from the IPO price, if you go back to 99, 2000, like that was maybe the best metric for how insane that bubble was what those IPOs would do.
Yeah.
And to include like you know, companies that are doing like $8.09 in revenue for, you know, whatever, like shoeboxes.com or something. And they would just be like, all right, we're IPOing. And then the IPO would come out and it'd be up 200% that week. And you're just like, wow.
Yep. Yeah.
And so to see Reddit kind of have a similar reaction, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of shenanigans that go into to pumping those in the early days, but
when you see a spread like a company like Reddit, right? Like do they want the stock to go up? Of course they do, right?
Yeah, but they're trying to make themselves sound all AI. You know,
yeah.
Jason, listening to their COO the other day, I was like, well, okay, wow.
Well, yeah, but he'd rather have IP. He would rather have the IPO price at 50% higher. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, I mean, it's, and so I always think that there's informational value, and there's people like, oh, no, it's just because guys, that's they sold a significant amount of stock into the market. Okay. If they thought the price was 50% higher, that's where it would have priced.
Right.
Right. They're not trying to give money away. Yep. Now, do they want to issue the IPO in a way that they're setting the stock up for success? So it can, of course they do, right? I'm not saying that, yeah.
Right. Just like no one's going to come, you know, say that their earnings are going to be 8% and then go deliver 3.
Yeah. I've talked to guys that do this before, and the numbers I've heard over and over, they feel like if they price an IPO perfectly, you should get a 5 to 10% pop on the first day.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but that is a sign of excess liquidity, and I always find it amusing when the public sits there and gets all excited about stuff like this. And I'm like, hey guys, you're betting that the people that own this stock and built the company are 50% off on their price estimates, and you're betting they're off to the low side. Think about that. Right? Just think about that, right? You're betting that that parent doesn't think their kid is good looking enough, right? Fat chance, right? You're sitting there going, I think your kid's a potential major leaguer. You just don't see the potential, right? It's just not something you're going to see very often.
Right.
So, and it fits perfectly in the liquidity narrative. And like we've talked about, and I think it's an important thing that I've learned. And I think you've said you've learned the same thing, which is, you know, you've got to be very careful in periods of times like this, because you see all the insanity, but it's not just a bubble where expectations have gone out of control. You've got governments and central banks doing things they've never done before. And one of the things that I've looked for is you don't want to just look for when markets get insane. You've got to look for something to change, right? An object in motion tends to stay in motion. And one of the ways that you can detect it, like we were talking about, you know, I think our track record speaks for itself. We really haven't gotten caught or hit in any downturn over the last 5 years. And one of the reasons is because you identify when there's a shift. You identify when there's a move in the force, there's a disturbance, right? Something that's going to disrupt the normal everyday flow. And despite us talking about all this sentiment stuff, there's nothing really disturbing the force at this point.
True, but what we did talk about in the investment meeting, and this is perfectly dovetails with this entire liquidity conversation, is next month is when everyone has to write a check to the IRS.
Yeah.
And if you think about capital gains, it was the NASDAQ was up like 40% or whatever. Like, there's going to be some big checks written to the government in April. So, and last year we let California and Georgia off the hook. They didn't have to pay their income taxes for a few months because of natural disasters. And I'm not aware of any of those this year. So the amount of checks written to the government are going to come out of people's bank accounts and money market funds and their equity accounts. Like that, you know, that funding doesn't just come out of the ether. It's real money. So that will be liquidity withdrawal from the economy. And unless the reverse repo facility just gets cratered in April to kind of sterilize that, which I don't really expect, it could be the kind of thing that tips over a very frothy, you know, peak sentiment, peak positioning kind of market. You know, the kind of thing that where you get a 5-15% correction, not saying it's the end of the cycle or, you know, the beginning of a brutal long bear market, but it could be the thing that finally gets you even just a healthy, you know, 5% pullback or something. But that could easily happen in April.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Or maybe the sell in May and go away actually happens for once.
Yeah, I don't know. All right, pal. We got anything else coming up this week that of note that we need to be paying attention to?
Tomorrow's a slow day. I think Thursday is too. So okay. not much.
All righty, guys. Well, hey, we will be back again tomorrow for another edition of the Dots. You're not going to want to miss it. And keep, you know, like we said, hopefully you guys will keep taking this journey with us, because it really is, if nothing else, educational. I mean, you're just seeing history happen on a daily basis in terms of what's driving markets and monetary policy, and may you live in interesting times. Like I've said, we, if nothing else, we can check that box, guys. So anyway, we'll keep moving through it and coping with it together. And hopefully you'll join us again tomorrow. And as always, if you listen, give us a subscribe, more subscribers, even better guests, not better, more guests, I should say.
Yeah, that's a good correction.
Yeah, more guests. Because truthfully, I mean that. I mean, I think we've had on some pretty amazing guests. So I just like to get on more. Anyway, we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.